Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know, the great names in American newspapers aren't really the Times and the Post and the Journal. It's the families, the Sulzbergers and the Grahams at the New York Times and the Washington Post, the Bancrofts at the Wall Street Journal. So imagine walking down to the end of your driveway one morning to this. The Wall Street Journal, brought to you by Rupert Murdoch. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. Details at 888-944-LIST and angieslist.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's May 1st. Glad to have you with us on this Tuesday. If you read the newspapers at all, you know this isn't a great time for the newspaper business. And yet, Rupert Murdoch wants in. Farther in, I guess we should say. Murdoch's News Corp already controls some big English and Australian papers, as well as the New York Post. Today, it made a play for Dow Jones, parent company of the Wall Street Journal. From New York Marketplace's Elisa Roth has the story.
Rupert Murdoch says he's ready to pay $5 billion for Dow Jones. That's $60 a share.
It's a hell of an offer, given the fact that the stock was $36 this morning.
That's Ed Adorino. He follows Dow Jones. But he says Dow Jones would be a bargain even at $60 a share, since its stock has been undervalued lately.
They have a great brand. They've expanded into the online business. They're building a global financial platform. Started the Saturday Journal. They got more color. They've been doing a lot of innovative things.
Traditional newspaper companies have been struggling to compete with the internet. Dow Jones is considered one of the few news companies that's done a good job handling the transition. Dow Jones says it's looking at Murdoch's offer, but buying the company won't involve just a simple shareholder vote. The company stock is controlled by the Bancroft family through a special class of shares. Newspaper analyst John Morton says he doubts the family will be tempted.
They have for decades made adamantly clear that they have no intention of allowing Dow Jones, and most particularly the Wall Street Journal, to fall into other hands. They've been very protective of the journal's independence, and unless that's changed, which I highly doubt, nothing will happen of this.
Indeed, the Wall Street Journal reports a family representative has told the company's board there are enough votes to block a buyout. It's unclear whether opponents mean it or are just looking for a higher bid. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Well, there you have the news of the day. Rupert Murdoch paying $5 billion for Dow Jones and the Wall Street Journal. The big question is, why? For the answer to that, we've gotten a hold of Tim Rutten at the Los Angeles Times. Tim, good to have you with us.
Very good to be with you.
So I put it to you, why?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. Possibly the most urgent is that Mr. Murdoch is about to launch a new financial news cable network, and getting a hold of Dow Jones brings not only a tremendous reporting staff, probably the best in the world when it comes to financial news, and also the instant credibility of a tremendous brand.
$5 billion, though, it's a lot of money to pay for credibility. Is there a newspaper in the world today that's worth $5 billion?
Well, that's a good question. I think Murdoch thinks so, and he doesn't often lose too much money. I think that there's a reason, though, that Dow Jones, Wall Street Journal is particularly attractive, and that's that of all the major American newspapers, the Wall Street Journal is furthest down the road to a sustainable digital future.
What does that mean? I mean, they have this online service, and they charge subscription fees. They've been more successful than anybody else. Is that enough to hang this on?
That plus what they'll get out of the synergy with the TV network. And remember, this is an interesting deal because this is synergy from the ground up, as opposed to, say, the Time Warner AOL deal or the Times Mirror Tribune Company. This is a synergy that builds from the ground up. Rupert Murdoch has a need. The Wall Street Journal has the ability to fill that need. There's no reason they couldn't work together. Then there's something else, and that's that I'd be very worried if I were the Financial Times. A part of Rupert Murdoch's heart still remains on Fleet Street, and I think he can envision turning the Wall Street Journal into an all-conquering international brand that basically squeezes the Financial Times out of the market.
The Wall Street Journal is getting all the press today, pun I suppose intended, but Dow Jones has a lot of other properties. I mean, it's not just a newspaper company.
Absolutely. It's a first-rate publishing company. And, you know, like Murdoch may also be attracted by the fact, is commonly said, when you subscribe to the Wall Street Journal, you get two newspapers. You get a great newspaper produced by the journalists, and then you get a very idiosyncratic right-wing editorial page that wields a great deal of influence. And Rupert Murdoch, with his subsidies of the Weekly Standard, has shown that he likes to keep his hand in that wing of American politics.
Mm-hmm. Fits neatly with the Fox channels.
Absolutely.
Tim Rutten writes the Regarding Media column for the Los Angeles Times. Tim, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Congressional Democrats sent the president their version of the Iraq War funding bill today. That's despite White House promises to send it right back with a veto attached, which the president did late this afternoon. There is some political symbolism in the timing of this whole thing. Today is the fourth anniversary of the president's mission accomplished speech. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports something's been lost in the debate over troop withdrawal deadlines. He says the price tag for the war is approaching $500 billion, just about 10 times the advertised price.
Remember Larry Lindsey?
I know he was in the Bush administration, but I can't remember under what department.
Even people who work a few blocks from the White House can't remember. For the record, Lindsey was President Bush's first economic policy advisor. He was fired after he said the war in Iraq could cost more than $100 billion. At the time, the official White House line was this war would be a bargain at $50 billion. Today, we've spent nearly 10 times that.
Paul Wolfowitz actually said that the war would pay for itself.
Joseph Stiglitz is a Nobel Prize-winning economist and served as former President Clinton's economic policy advisor.
You know, the number $500 billion is clearly a mind-boggling number.
So without a war to pay for, what could you do with that kind of money?
For just a little bit more than $500 billion, you could have fixed the Social Security problem for the next 75 years.
Or you could have doubled foreign aid to developing countries. Not just aid from the U.S., but all development aid, period. But Robert Hormats, the author of The Price of Liberty, a new book on paying for America's wars, says in comparison to past conflicts, the war in Iraq is a steal. The Second World War cost more than $5 trillion when you adjust for inflation, and Vietnam cost about $650 billion.
We're definitely trying to fight the war on the cheap. And I think that's one of the things missing in this war, that Americans have not been asked to make any sacrifices.
Hormats argues the only ones sacrificing are the troops, who in some cases, despite this war's price tag, still aren't getting what they need. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Elsewhere in the nation's capital today, the Food and Drug Administration appointed a food safety czar. The FDA is trying to deal with the fallout from the contaminated pet food scandal, and it's probably not a coincidence that Congress started looking at whether the agency is actually doing its job today. Ashley Montite reports.
Former Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson has said he worries every night about threats to the U.S. food supply. He belongs to a lobbying group called the Coalition for a Stronger FDA. Former FDA Commissioner William Hubbard is also a member. He says these days the FDA is overwhelmed by a flood of food imports from around the world. As for the solution,
my group believes it is an immediate and massive infusion of resources that allows FDA inspectors to examine and test these commodities before they get in our food.
Right now, the FDA inspects just 1% of the food shipments entering the U.S. Bob Bauer is president of the Association of Food Industries, which represents food importers. He says importers themselves inspect about 25% of products.
No company wants its product to cause any harm to anybody, not only because, you know, they just don't want to see that from a human standpoint, but also the monetary impact to them would be tremendous. Obviously, they've spent, in many cases, you know, most of their lives trying to build up these companies and build up these brands.
He says there are frequent inspections of new products. They become more random over time. Bauer says the FDA couldn't carry out that many checks or the U.S. food supply would slow to a costly trickle. But William Hubbard says it must do more.
We believe our food is safe, but the risk, the threat is substantial. And when FDA is so weak in its capacity to review these foods, it's clear that foreign exporters can send food here with impunity if it's unsafe.
In fact, he says some experts believe foreign countries send the U.S. their worst food, knowing the FDA is too stretched to notice. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
It was sort of topsy-turvy on Wall Street today, though investors eventually did wind up on top. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Immigration rallies around the country this May Day have been far smaller this year than last, even as Congress gets ready for another go-round at immigration reform. The Senate set the end of this month as a deadline for passing something. Lawmakers in the House do have a bill pending. They're just waiting to see what the Senate manages to do. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports backroom politicking hasn't done much so far.
Organizers of this spring's immigration marches and rallies acknowledge the public's participation has dropped from last year. But Clarissa Martinez with the Coalition for Comprehensive Immigration Reform says last November's elections changed things.
Last year, we had a proposal that attempted to criminalize not only undocumented immigrants, but almost anybody who came into contact with them, which led the Catholic Church to even denounce that legislation.
This year, recognizing that the looming presidential election campaign will swamp efforts to find compromises, Senate Democratic leader Harry Reid scheduled the last 2 weeks of May for floor debate on immigration. But despite intense closed-door negotiations, senators have yet to find a bill that would attract the 60 votes needed to overcome a filibuster. The chief immigration lobbyist for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, Randall Johnson, is losing confidence a bill can be passed this year.
I would have rated it probably 70-30 a few months ago, and I'll put it at 50-50 now.
The chamber supports reform, but Johnson says businesses and Republicans are fighting Democrats' insistence on setting minimum wages for guest workers. To get more Republicans on board, Democratic negotiators, such as Senator Robert Menendez of New Jersey, are considering requiring illegal immigrants to return to their home countries before they may apply for residency in the U.S. It's called a touchback.
If it is done in a way in which that individual applies in their native country but is allowed to come back after such an application, particularly when they have family here, as they wait for that decision to be dispositive, it might very well be possible.
Negotiators are using the end of May deadline as pressure to gain concessions. But the White House, which has been trying to gather Republican support for a legalization plan for most undocumented immigrants, has set its own timetable of August for a final bill. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The immigration rallies have been here today, that is to say in the United States. But in Mexico, President Felipe Calderón has been trying to solve what he sees as an emigration problem. Pamela Starr studies Latin America at the Eurasia Group. That's a political risk consulting firm. Pamela, good to talk to you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
When President Calderón was elected, he sort of ran on a platform as the jobs candidate, that he was going to create jobs down there, in part sort of to keep the Mexican population home. How is that going for him?
Well, it's going to be a long, hard slog. Calderón is going to have to do some heavy restructuring of the Mexican economy. Which is not great news for the United States in terms of the migration issue. But the very positive news is that Calderón is the first Mexican president to admit that Mexico indeed is part of the migration problem and that it needs to begin resolving the problem at home by creating more jobs.
Is the Mexican economy set up to structurally add new jobs at a quick pace?
It's not, and that's what Calderón has to do. He has to restructure key elements of the economy. The main things he has to do is he needs to implement a labor reform, and he needs to increase competition, particularly in the area of cement and in telecom, so that the prices on those become lower and the Mexican economy therefore becomes more competitive internationally.
Other than jobs, is he doing anything in terms of social programs that might give people an added incentive to remain at home?
He's trying to do two or three things. One of the things he's trying to do is to add to Mexico's anti-poverty program that's known as Opportunities. And the idea is that you actually pay mothers to keep their children at home. It's not like U.S. welfare where you pay mothers to be at home mothers, but rather the idea is to keep kids in school and to get them to health clinics so they get their immunizations. That program now covers children in very poor areas through high school. What Calderon wants to do is extend that into their first job. It's called his First Jobs Program, in which the government pays all of the health and retirement benefits for workers on behalf of the firms if companies hire these individuals who are coming out of this anti-poverty program.
Do you think when all is said and done that anything that's happening in Mexico City is going to be enough to change the terms of the debate here?
I don't. I think Mexico needs to do it precisely what it's doing. Mexico is trying to create jobs because it's in the Mexican national interest, not because it's going to change U.S. public opinion. U.S. public opinion, I don't see how it's going to change significantly in the near term about Mexico, simply because of the amount of political hay that can be made playing to irrational emotions about migrants. It is a useful tool for politicians when they want to be reelected and they want to play on an emotional issue in the United States.
Pamela Starr is a Latin America analyst at the Eurasia Group. Ms. Starr, thanks a lot for your time.
It was a pleasure to be here, Guy.
Coming up, the relative wealth of nations.
I never thought I'd be rich. Then my wife and I moved to Mali.
But first, let's do the numbers. The markets made a little headway today. The Dow Industrials gained 73 points, 0.5% to close at 13,136. The NASDAQ gained 6 points, closing up 0.25% to 2531. The S&P 500 rose 3 points. That's also about 0.25%, ended the day at 1486. That $5 billion bid from News Corp for Dow Jones lifted several boats, but News Corp washed off more than 4% as Dow Jones rode the wave up the double nickel about 55%. The New York Times crested up 5%. The Washington Post swelled 2.8%. Microsoft rose 1.5% today on news that it might try to buy an internet advertising company. But, as so often happens, the real beneficiary of the rumor was the object of its affections, 24/7 Real Media. That company shot up 20%. Liz Claiborne tumbled more than 17%. The apparel maker's earnings missed estimates. Bond prices were mixed. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.64%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. And by The Economist magazine, which tells not only what's happening around the world each week, but why. The Economist, at newsstands, in bookstores, and at economist.com. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for March. The House Science and Technology Subcommittee on Space and Aeronautics discusses NASA's space programs and budget issues. And a man who can be credited with bringing order to countless meetings was born on May 2, 1837. We can thank U.S. Army General Henry M. Robert for Robert's Rules of Order. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Ben Bernanke took a swing through Big Sky country today. The great state of Montana is hosting an economic development summit. The Fed chairman took the opportunity to talk free trade. He cautioned against tariffs and quotas to protect American industry. He said that would only hurt the U.S. economy. That's a tough sell in a country that's lost millions of jobs to foreign competition already and might lose millions more. But commentator Steve Moore says the Fed chairman's right on the mark.
American workers say they are now more worried about job losses and pay cuts than ever before. One word explains these worker anxieties: globalization. Economist Alan Blinder of Princeton warns that over the next 20 years, 40 million jobs may be shipped overseas due to free trade and new labor-saving technologies. Scary stuff, but there's another side to this story. America gains at least as many jobs as it loses from trade. The jobs we do lose tend to be low-skilled and low-wage. The jobs we gain require talent and productivity and thus command higher pay. Today, about one of every three new jobs in America is related to international trade. About 57 million Americans work for businesses engaged in export or import. It's a well-kept secret that America's exports have soared by nearly half since 2001. Meanwhile, low-cost imports make products ranging from flat-screen TVs to cars a lot more affordable to the poor and middle class. Yes, America will probably lose some 40 million jobs due to technology and trade in coming decades. We will also create far more than that in fields we can hardly conceive of today. Millions of Americans now work in technology, financial services, telecommunications, and other knowledge-based occupations that didn't even exist 40 years ago. Steel mills have given way to computer labs and internet highways. History teaches us that the best way for America to lose jobs is to try to protect them. The infamous Smoot-Hawley tariffs in the late 1920s helped trigger the Great Depression, when one of every four Americans lost his job. President Bill Clinton said it best: in the 21st century global marketplace, America must compete, not retreat.
Stephen Moore is senior economics writer for the Wall Street Journal's editorial page. If you've got some thoughts to share, marketplace.org is our website. Click on that link that says contact. Matthew Algio used to be one of our staff reporters here in Los Angeles. He left a couple of years ago and moved to West Africa, Mali to be precise, where his wife had been assigned as a foreign service officer in the American Embassy in the capital of Bamako. Almost overnight, they went from living in L.A. on a public radio salary, which isn't really saying too much, to a spot in the far upper class of one of the poorest countries on earth. Matthew told us yesterday on the program about Malians living on less than a dollar a day. Today, we learn wealth can be a relative thing.
I never thought I'd be rich. Then my wife and I moved to Mali. Our house, supplied by the U.S. government, is palatial by Malian standards, with air conditioning and a swimming pool. Between us, my wife and I earn about $60,000 a year, though she earns nearly all of it. The average Malian makes less than $500 a year. So here, anyway, we are fabulously wealthy. The transition from the middle class to the upper crust hasn't been easy. The hardest part for me has been becoming a boss. Expats are a major source of employment here, and we're practically required to hire domestic help. Our gardener is Amadou Koulibaly. 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, Amadou sweeps dust off the patio and waters the flowers. He also looks after the pool. We pay him about a dollar an hour, the going rate for domestic workers here. Together with the money he makes working at another house, Amadou earns more than $200 a month. But it all goes to support a very large extended family.
They are feeding 42 people.
How many?
42 people.
42 people?
42.
Besides his wife and three daughters, those 42 people include Amadou's 69-year-old father, his father's two wives, and various brothers, sisters, in-laws, nieces, and nephews. Of the 42, only Amadou and three of his brothers have jobs. They support the whole family. That's not unusual in Mali, where families tend to be large, partly because polygamy is legal, and jobs tend to be scarce. Amadou recently invited me to his house. Ducking through a small doorway, I step into an open courtyard. surrounded on three sides by small windowless rooms built of mud bricks and concrete. Small children, some naked, playfully chase several chickens. There is no plumbing or electricity. Food is prepared on an open fire in a corner of the courtyard. The usual meal is rice or millet, an inexpensive grain. The chickens are saved for special occasions. Amadou takes me to the room he shares with his wife and their three daughters. It is tiny, spotless, and stifling. The walls are bare except for a picture of his favorite Islamic preacher. Amadou says he would like to build a house for his wife and children, but that would cost about $20,000, more than he could ever hope to afford. He says his only goal in life is to keep his family fed.
I don't see any bright future for me, because whatever you get, you eat it. That's why there is no future.
My wife and I have an annual income that is roughly 6,000% higher than the average Malians. To equal this standard of living back home, we'd need to earn more than $2 million a year. In reality, our combined income is slightly below the national average in the United States. We certainly couldn't afford to buy a house in Los Angeles or Washington. But when I explain this to Amadou, he finds it impossible to believe we are anything but rich.
When American people come here and say that they don't have any money, we can't understand it. Because what we hear is that in America, even those who are unemployed, they are paid. So when you say that you are not rich, we can't understand it.
Next year, my wife and I will move to Rome for her next post. We definitely won't be able to afford to hire any help there, which is just fine with me. On the whole, I think I prefer being middle class. But when we leave Bamako, Amadou will lose half his income. We will try to help him catch on with another expat family, but there's always a chance he won't get hired. Meanwhile, his family just keeps getting bigger. Amadou and his wife are expecting their fourth child in about a month. In Bamako, Mali, I'm Matthew Algio for Marketplace.
If you missed it yesterday, part one of Matthew's report is on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, it's exam and graduation time at most colleges and universities. Not so, perhaps, for 34 students at Duke University's Fuqua School of Business. School officials said today they shared answers on a take-home exam. That's a no-no, as you might imagine, and up to nine of those students might be expelled for violating Duke's honor code. U.S. News ranks Duke's business school 12th in the country. Tuition and fees run nearly $50,000 a year, but the payoff is almost immediate. Graduates make an average of $93,000 right out of school, unless they cheat, I suppose. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow up 73 points, 0.5%. The new record's 13,136. The NASDAQ up 6 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 rose 3 points. That's 0.25% there as well. Thanks to Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Wendy Sykes. Next time on this program, China takes a crack at reality TV.
Chinese leaders hope Happy Boys will become the model reality show for a more virtuous free market China. It will contain no harsh criticism, weepy fans, vulgar songs, or other unspecified weirdness.
I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.